a better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Rick Spezak, News Director for Progressive News Network. I want to tell you it's wonderful to have you on tonight. We've got some great guests for you. We've got Miss Lori Price of Citizens for Legitimate Government. We've got Miss Chris Costello of the Sierra Club, who's going to be talking about our water issues here in Florida. And then, of course, we've got a regular here on the show, Mr. Luis Cuevas, Executive Director of Progressive Push, a fine leader. And let's now get to the news. First, I want to bring you this quote from Eugene Debs. Eugene Debs said once in court, "Your Honor, years ago, I recognized my kinship with all living beings, and I made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on earth. I said it then, as I say it now, while there is a lower class, I am in it. And when there is a criminal element, I am of it. And while there is a soul in prison, I am not free." Thus saith Eugene Debs, a leader, a humanitarian, a man jailed for his work for peace. Now, the news. Obama backs away from his net neutrality campaign promise after the FCC vote. Barack Obama was crystal clear during the 2008 campaign about his commitment to ensuring equal treatment for all online content over American broadband lines. And here's his statement for those of you who actually have ears. Here we go.
And as president, I intend to work with you to write the next chapter in the story of American innovation. That's part of the reason why I'm running for President of the United States. To seize this moment, we have to ensure free and full exchange of information. And that starts with an open internet. I will take a backseat to no one in my commitment to network neutrality. Because once providers start to privilege some applications or websites over others, then the smaller voices get squeezed out and we all lose. And the internet is perhaps the most open network in history, and we have to keep it that way.
Well said, candidate Barack Obama. And yet, even though he'll take no backseat to anyone, in fact, in 2007 campaign forum, he went so far as specifically promised that his FCC commission appointments would defend the principle of a level playing field for whoever has the best ideas, as he meant the loudest voice, because, of course, according to the Supreme Court, cash equals speech. There we go. On Thursday, just past, the president made no public statement when the three appointees he had placed on the FCC voted to move forward with a plan to allow broadband carriers to provide exclusive fast lanes to certain corporations to get their content transmitted online. As you may know, I teach web design, I teach web media, web marketing, and I told my students, if this is fully implemented, the small internet business will disappear. There will only be room for the big feet of the large corporate communicators. Just as once broadcast was for the people, and then the internet was for the people, well, those days are behind us. On U.S. telecommunications regulators on Thursday formally produced a new, quote, net neutrality rule that may let the internet service providers charge content companies for faster and more reliable delivery of their traffic to users. Federal Communications Commission Chairman Thomas Wheeler has come under fire from consumer advocates and technology companies alike for proposing to allow some commercially reasonable deals in which content companies could pay broadband providers to prioritize traffic for their networks. Wheeler's two fellow Democrats at the FCC concurred with him on a 3-2 vote to advance the proposal and begin formal collecting of public comments, though they expressed certain, you know, misgivings about the plan. By the way, these stories come to us by one of our great content providers these days from Citizens for Legitimate Government, and in fact, the senior producer, Ms. Lori Price, will be with us to talk about her take on journalism and the news today. Once again, Senator Elizabeth Warren tells the truth. One of Senator Elizabeth Warren's top priorities since coming to Washington has been opening up of ongoing international trade talks to public scrutiny. She has on several occasions criticized the secret nature of negotiations and has pressed the administrative trade representative directly about transparency. Transparency? Ha, God, TPP has anything but transparency scribbled all over its secret folders. On Wednesday night in Washington, Public Citizen Annual Gala, Warren spoke about the trade deal in one of her most direct remarks to date on the issue and revealed some of the inside details about the debate in Congress. From what I hear, Wall Street, pharmaceuticals, telecom, big polluters, and outsourcers are all salivating at the chance to rig the deal in the upcoming trade talks. So the question is, why are trade talks secret? You'll love the answer. Boy, the things you learn on Capitol Hill, Warren said. I actually have had supporters of the deal say to me, they have to be secret because if the American people knew what was actually in them, they would be opposed. Well, from then on, Warren launched a direct broadside on the trade deals, which would include the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and suggested that it should be scuttled. Think about it. Real people. People with jobs at stake. Small business owners who don't want to compete with overseas companies that dump their waste in rivers and hire workers for a dollar a day. These people without an army of lobbyists, they would be opposed. And believe me, if people across this country would oppose it to a particular trade agreement, maybe that trade agreement just shouldn't happen. Hey, more news on that Corexit that didn't disappear. Oh, by the way, the oil didn't disappear in the Gulf either. On April 19, 2013, there was a new report released, deadly dispersants in the Gulf are public health and environmental tragedies the new norm for oil spill cleanups. The report details the devastating long-term effects on human health in the Gulf of Mexico ecosystem stemming from BP and the federal government's widespread use of the dispersant Corexit in response to the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill. There was a team-up with the not-for-profit Louisiana Environmental Action Network to launch the effort in August 2011 after repeatedly hearing from Gulf residents and the cleanup workers that the official statements from representatives of BP and the federal government were false and misleading in the wake of Deepwater Horizon disaster. Over the next 20 months, GAP collected data and evidence from over two dozen employees and citizen whistleblowers who experienced the cleanup effects firsthand. GAP studied the data from extensive Freedom of Information Act requests, taking together the documents and the eyewitness testimony belie repeated corporate and government rhetoric that Corexit is not dangerous. Worse than this, evidence suggests that the cleanup effort has been more destructive to human health and the environment than the actual spill itself. Conclusions from the report strongly suggest that the dispersant Corexit was widely applied in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon explosion because it created a false impression that the oil just disappeared. In reality, the oil and Corexit mixture became less visible, yet much more toxic than oil alone. Let's see. Nonetheless, indications are that both BP and the government were pleased with what Corexit accomplished. Oh, boy, there we go. Substance? Never mind. We're looking for appearance. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to cut short our news segment right now because I want to bring on Ms. Lori Price of Citizens for Legitimate Government. Lori, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show.
Lori, we have followed your work for so long and have just continued to be impressed with the quality of the journalism that your presentation provides to Americans and citizens across the world who want to stay informed. Lori, could you talk a little bit about how you got involved with this?
Thank you so much, first of all. Yes, it was the domain lineage can be traced to the 2000 stolen election. That's where the Citizens for Legitimate Government and legitgov.org comes from. So we sort of dropped the Citizens for Legitimate Government part now and just call it ourselves CLG News because, you know, it's not a birther site, which people have actually confused us with a few years ago.
People get confused so easy.
I'm sorry?
I said people get confused so easy.
So when you're saying there's not legitimate government right off the bat in your namesake and, you know, there was question about that whole issue with Obama and the birth certificate. But anyway, so we compile the news and put that out in a newsletter every couple of days and try to report some of the stories that get less coverage or aren't being covered correctly. For example, Fukushima, where the mainstream media, when they do report it, refers to the radiation as toxic water versus radioactive water. There's certain words that are no longer used, and we continually use words that should be that are the correct words, okay?
But absolutely.
Anyway, so we do a news compilation of lesser covered items and topics and or stories that aren't getting covered sort of properly. That's what we do. We put the summaries in a newsletter and send that out, and you can go to the site during the day or at night, and you'll see all the news as it builds for the day, and then eventually a newsletter is sent with the last 20, 25 summaries with
you know,
the links to the stories.
Lori, there's so many issues of such great import and just incredible impact. Stories that just don't get any kind of play whatsoever in mainstream media. Let me just talk to you about a couple of the stories that occasionally we get a glimpse of in mainstream media. It seems that there's been some talk about this net neutrality issue. Now, what do you think people need to understand about this odd scientific sounding techno geek kind of word? What does net neutrality actually mean, and what should people understand about it?
Well, first of all, the U.S. Internet standards technically are generally lower than other countries, which is something that no one ever talks about. Just like in years about healthcare, we never really heard that there are other industrialized nations with single payer that sort of works, generally works. You know, there's certain topics that are just never covered, and one is the U.S. for what we pay is a lot isn't the same quality as other nations where people pay less and get more, okay? But that having been said, net neutrality would generally put certain corporations ahead of others and get their word out, and it would become, you know, a pay-to-play system, something basically. And so basically, if you're interested in Netflix or something, and that's just an example, and they would have subscribers pay, and they would end up the people that carry Netflix would charge higher fees and pass those on to consumers. And meanwhile, you know, they'd get fast-tracked. Their message and their content would be fast-tracked, and people, say, who want to read the CLG newsletter, which already gets thwarted by many censors along the way, Google relegating it to the spam bin, for example, sources like the CLG newsletter might not get prioritized. So it's basically a disaster. And whether it's CLG News or some other small, you know, blog or other newsletter, if it's not corporate material, there would be no priority to get that through on the same rate of speed as, say, the story of Kim Kardashian in a movie or something, hypothetically. So that's what it would do. It's a disaster.
And I imagine you're about as surprised as I am that President Obama doesn't remember the comments of candidate Obama on this issue.
He doesn't remember a lot. Well, I have a theory on President Obama. You know, when it was candidate Obama, I actually was taken in, I admit, by some of the rhetoric and some of the fancy speeches. And the CLG founder and chair, Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, he was jumping up and down saying, "You're going to get fooled by this guy," basically. And, you know, he was right. But it's deeper than that. For example, one topic that never gets covered is the filibuster in the Senate. You know, it's very difficult to achieve 60 votes on something. I mean, you know, think about it. It would have to be an issue that would just garner tremendous support across all divisions of politics, okay? And the fact that the Republicans just say, I filibuster, they don't actually have to filibuster. But when you think about it, that's destroyed many good legislative acts that Democrats put forward. And the fact that President Obama never really spoke out about that, I mean, he did with his nominees recently. They came up with a horrible deal. But the fact that the media and President Obama and Democrats didn't jump up and down about the filibuster, which has prevented any decent legislation, when you think about it, from passing. And what's going to happen if that I've put this out on my Twitter account, and I haven't read this anywhere, just something I'm thinking. If the Republicans were to take the Senate, suddenly you're going to see a change of heart about the filibuster. Suddenly it'll be, oh, the Democrats are holding up production, and that's the nuclear option, and we'll be back to all those kind of complaints. And the mainstream media, I guarantee you, will be talking about how the Democrats are stopping any progress of the country and all this. So it should be interesting, but I think, going back to what you said about President Obama, I think he's kept things basically corporate-friendly and CIA-friendly by keeping that filibuster right there in place. So we get all Republican, basically, legislation through, and that's basically it. That's my theory on him.
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats in the Senate cried real crocodile tears over that whole issue. Time and time again, oh, we just can't do anything because of those mean Republicans. Oh, my gosh.
And that's why people don't vote in the midterms. I mean, I'm just saying, when you see poll after poll, when the issues are broken down, some of these issues get 75-80% support of certain Democratic principles, okay, like releasing who's behind the dark money, that insurance companies shouldn't drop people with pre-existing conditions. All those topics score high in polls across the parties. Well, but the reason why people don't run out and push for Democrats is because when they get in, they basically, essentially, for the most part, do nothing but cave in and surrender to corporate moneyed interests, you know, and foreign policy disasters. So it's like people think, why vote when we're just going to have the same? We're not going to get anything. That's why I think, whereas the Tea Party and the Republicans can put out people as strict adherence to their principles, and people go, you know, it fires up their base, and they you know, as much as we may not like Ted Cruz shutting down the government, at least he stood true to the people he promised when he ran for office. I mean, you know, and we don't have somebody on the equivalent on the other side to do that.
Yep. Another issue that gets very biased coverage, I think, is the whole issue of that, oh my gosh, they're hoping for a war again. This time it's Ukraine.
Issue.
Do you think it odd that after outing the ambassador's speech about fuck Europe, and we've got our own boys in there, and we're sending in we're supporting the fascists there to overthrow a government? Isn't it odd that that government got overthrown? I mean, why are we not connecting the dots here? It seems not that big a jump.
Okay, Shell and Chevron have signed deals in the Ukraine for their oil, the gas, the fracking, and all that. And what really annoys me about the Ukraine issue, and I actually lost a few subscribers who weren't on the same, you know, page as I did. I actually founded a little Facebook spinoff group called U.S. Out of Ukraine, by the way. Well, there's the main CLG group on Facebook, but that's a little spinoff. But the point I'm saying is it infuriated me. The whole issue, I mean, has infuriated me with this, because I see moneyed interest. We have 400 mercenaries over there, Academy, which was the change from Blackwater, which became XE, then Academy. But the thing is, we have mercenaries there fighting really for fascism, these disgusting people that you know, shot people who jumped from a burning building. And, you know, I noticed how the media covered it when a U.S. interest side does war crimes, it's, well, both sides are fighting. But, you know, you notice that they never put a blame on the mainstream media when it's U.S.-backed war crimes. It's just, oh, that's their issue, you know, fighting between the two. Never take a stand against war crimes, you know, that the U.S. backs, pays for, funds, or defends. Never, ever, ever, I notice. But anyway, yes, the U.S.-Ukraine issue really annoys me. $1 billion in loan guarantees, and I put a comment up on CLG saying, "Too bad U.S. students can't get those kind of student loan, you know, U.S. those kind of student loan deals." Yeah.
Well, I see that there is some concern on the employment front. Joe Biden's son has got a job
right.
with the gas company that works in the Ukraine. So, I mean, it's not that they're completely oblivious to the jobs issue, isn't that great?
Yes, and there's another politician. It slips my mind. Somebody else has an interest there, too, and I can't have a block on the name right now. But, yes, there's two people. But it is unbelievable. It's like they already decide. The U.S. makes all these decisions all over the world on everything. The U.S. knows is in everybody's business all over the planet. It's amazing. And people, it's funny. There's never I've made several comments on the CLG site about no money to fix interstates, the potholes. You know, or like, you know, caverns. We have these Mariana Trench deep potholes, I put. We can't get them fixed, but there's money to give. You know, they're building a new wing at Guantanamo to refurbish one of the wings there. Yeah, I put that up. I think it's $69 million. I don't, you know, this was like a couple weeks ago. I don't remember the number. But something in the millions for Guantanamo Bay, the prison. I mean, this is insane. The money pit that goes to things that you never hear a complaint from the GOP or, you know, most Democrats when the money gets wasted like this, but there's no money for anything for the people at all in this country. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, where's the budget balancing for that expenditure, right? Well, I saw another story that was interesting about Guantanamo, and I'm sure that this one's going to find the black hole of American media. A judge has, we'll have to say requested, that they don't destroy any of the documents related to the force feeding of prisoners down there. And it brought me in mind of those the videotapes of the what's the gentle euphemism, the enhanced interrogation.
Oh yeah, 92 hours or something. 92.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, these things find the black hole, and now the recent Clapper document that was from March, but didn't get released till April, of course. There's always a little delay. I know, always a little bit of a lag in the release. But anyway, you can't talk to the media unless an intelligence official approves of discussing with the media. I mean, they cover these documents, they cover them up, and if another country did this, that's what gets me. Can you imagine if another country did the stuff that the U.S. does? Well, we'd be jumping up and down if they waterboarded and all that.
Well,
fact, they called it torture back when other people did it to U.S. soldiers. But yes, you're saying?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I wonder where the Benghazi boys are on all those lies to Congress by our head of the CIA and head of NSA. It was the least lie he could give. Really? Really? Okay, you got a guy who's admitting that he's lying to Congress under oath, and this is not a problem, but Benghazi, where all they're trying to do is cover up for the CIA, that's a huge problem. It just, you know, the hypocrisy is literally extra galactic. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I also noticed an interesting story on another one of my favorite progressive journals where they talk about conservatives were praising the Antarctic ice sheet melt as an expression of free enterprise.
Oh, gosh. The stupidity, the lack of scientific knowledge, I mean, that's another issue that gets me. It makes me crazy, you know, the lies. I mean, global warming is a serious problem. And by the way, every media outlet almost, I can almost say, except for CLG, but most media outlets, okay, refer to it now but as climate change, okay? Now, that was a Frank Luns term to get people to stop believing in global warming. And true enough, the polls are now down. It used to be like 90% almost, I think, 80-90%, at least in Connecticut, of people believed that global warming was a huge problem. And those numbers are now down, and that's because of the corporate right-wing media getting rid of that term. You don't hear it anymore, even on MSNBC, global warming. Now the term is climate change, which is not as, to me, global warming is
very
more
neutral.
The point. Right. So I cross out the term climate change and put global warming in on the CLG. Yeah, it was one of my cross outs. Like the toxic, I changed to radioactive to another change I make. But yeah, they're trying to get us to not be afraid of these issues, these problems like nuclear power meltdowns, you know, global warming. They're trying to make us think they're not problems, you know, and they are.
I try to watch the Sunday propaganda shows just to stay in touch with what the official lie is. And I was stunned. I mean, the brass ovaries on some of these people, you know. One of the interesting speeches that I saw today on two different of the mainstream media networks was they trotted out little Timmy Geithner, who's got a revision book that's explaining why it was that we had to bail out those banks and not all the people. And, you know, disingenuous, you know, the guy, you know, doesn't pass the Sacrin test. You know, he's saying, well, you know, I wasn't really qualified. I didn't want them to do this. It was really important. And it really, you know, it rescued the world, you know. And, yeah, we can cut loose the people and just pay the bankers. Now, it seems to me the question somebody should have asked is, well, if we gave the people the money to pay their mortgages, then the people and the bankers would have been rescued. But nobody seems to raise that question.
That was one of the earlier Obama sellouts that freaked me out was the fact, in my opinion, he could have, by just executive order, given the word that judges can at least use discretion. I don't know how this would pass legally. I should add that, but judges could use discretion on the foreclosures because some judges said, I don't think this person should be kicked out, but I'm forced to. They could have stemmed that tide of the foreclosures when he got in office. And the fact he didn't do anything on that one issue alone scared me, and I knew that he was going to be a huge sellout or whatever, cave-in fraud, whatever word you want to use. But, yeah, the foreclosures, and then we find out later they were robo-signing and all that and accepted a very small settlement for the people. You know, what good is it to get $500 if you lost your house? I mean, really. So, you know, I'm just saying that was an early Obama sellout to me that really just rang the bell for me about him.
Yeah, absolutely. Another issue that I think didn't get enough coverage, and I'm sure that the good people at CLG covered, mm-hmm. was that wonderful global fast food strike.
Oh, it did not get enough coverage. It's true. It's ridiculous. I mean, my solution to the problem that is Walmart with their corporate welfare, I mean, you know, bailing out Walmart just de facto because of the wages, is if people would just stop going to, I mean, I hate to stop going to these fast food places, and I guess they are ultimately cheaper and quick if you only have, you know, a short time for your lunch break, but people just really got to work around them. Just stop going to any place like that. Walmart, you really don't save money there anyway. I mean, let's face it, they're not the best prices anyway. There's other companies you can go to. But just stop buying, you know, Koch Industries products. Stop going to Walmart. Stop going to McDonald's. I mean, there's got to be a way around this. That's the only signal to send. I don't know how else they're going to get anything accomplished because these politicians are in the pockets of these big business and they vote no, even if some of them may privately support a higher wage.
You know, the positive takeaway that I get from that great global action was that people, you know, the rhetoric of Occupy, which was this paycheck disparity, this two-tier justice, this two-tier employment, this two-tier salary structure, that has been internalized. Now people take that knowledge and now they're beginning to act on it. And I mean, if you can think of anybody less empowered than the poor folks who are working for that ultra minimum wage there at McDonald's and Wendy's and all these fast food places. I had a woman on the show a few weeks back from SEIU under their training and support. She had been there for over 20 years, and she still got no benefits whatsoever. Oh. She's working at their beck and call. They wanted to clock in and work off the clock. I mean, and this is somebody who has this benign face of a smiling clown on the outside, but is just a horrible, blood-sucking vampire of a company in reality.
Right. I mean, that thing, that signing in and then being off the clock, that's not legal. But yeah, I mean, that's got to be stopped immediately. I mean, that particular small, I know that's one aspect, but that one issue has got to be addressed. Yeah, the wages have got to go up, minimum wage. But you know what the problem is, and you know, the MSNBC brings this up as, you know, it's one of the few things that they do bring up that's true, is that this point, if a Republican does say, you know what, people should increase their wages, they will be challenged by a moneyed person to the right. I mean, I'm just saying, whether it's Tea Party or a farther right Tea Party, if a Republican actually tries, or even a Democrat, they will be challenged by a business interest. And with the unlimited money going in, they sell off. They say, well, I can't do this because I'll be primaried. I mean, I'm just saying, and that's one of the problems. That's why it's got to, the people just stop patronizing these businesses and these companies and Walmart, and they saw their business dropped. But I support the protests and all that. I mean, I hope it helps, but I just see these sellout politicians not voting for these issues.
You know, I had an experience that really taught me a lot about the granular level of this economic hypocrisy. I teach, and I work really hard to keep my politics out of my teaching, and so I try to really keep my mouth shut on political matters in the classroom. But one day I had a new student walk in, and the first thing he said to me was, "I'm a tea bagger," and I knew what he meant, and I tried not to, you know, totally chuckle aloud. And I said, well, that's very interesting. And I thought, you know, wow, tell me your politics as you walk in the door. Okay, fine. And he started to tell me that the big problem in this country was the damn Mexicans. And you know, I as much as I try to keep my mouth shut, I had to say something. And I said, you know, I am second generation immigrant. Now, my grandparents came to this country, and I can tell you right off the bat that they came not just for political freedom, but they came for a better economic life. And if there's anything you can say about the migrants from the Caribbean and from Central and South America, they're coming up here for a better economic life. That's the way it works. That's what human beings do. They try to find better hunting ground, if you will, you know, make it that simple. And he said, yeah, but if you look at any construction site, boy, there's nothing but those people out there, and they're just killing our wages. And I said, no, you know, some poor guy working in your garden, he is not affecting your wage structure. And then he turns to me very clear-eyed, as if he wanted to make sure that I knew just how hypocritical he was. And he said, you know, but I'll tell you what, when I get a project, I hire those people. They work hard and for next to nothing.
Oh.
And I thought, boy, oh, boy, you hate them, but you'll use them, no questions asked. And it just seemed to me that was a real perfect illustration of how this economic warfare, this class warfare that has been ginned up by politicians for the worst of reasons, ends up impacting the lives of simple working people who ask for nothing more than to make a living. And here they've got this guy pitted against these immigrants. And it's just a shame. It's a real shame because nobody benefits except the rich.
Yeah, it's ridiculous to say one group of people causes a down. I mean, just saying that is like insane. But in general, I think corporations and companies pay high wages. And, you know, like what he's saying about you're taking advantage of a human being no matter where they're from if you're paying them next to nothing and forcing them to work really hard and they – you know, it's not a proper system to do that. The wages should be higher around, you know, and then you bring in people legally and all that, immigration, and it's fine. But you got to pay people higher wages in general, no matter who you're paying, no matter where they're from or what they're doing. But I believe that that's, you know, the incentive of bringing people over to work for next to nothing, they have no benefits, no rights, that's all just the system, no matter what the whole, no matter who it is in general, in my opinion.
You know,
wages should be higher.
Yep. There's another other issue that I wanted to talk to you about, which I think is very, in a sort of backhanded way, may actually help. You know, there's been an awful lot of talk about the XL pipeline. And there's been a slightly more attention given to all the other pipelines that are doing all the other damage that's being done. And, of course, we had the spills in Minnesota and Michigan that got a little teeny bit of coverage. We got the spill in Arkansas that had a little bit of coverage. We had those terrible, terrible spills in West Virginia that had their little bit of coverage. And now we just had this new spill in downtown L.A. And I can't help but think that maybe with an oil spill in downtown L.A. where the mass media is so centered, maybe if they trip over it, it'll actually get some coverage. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. I have a crazy theory on that. Is I think these companies really kind of don't care too much about these spills because they're going to make a crazy linkage to say, well, if we had one big massive pipeline to bring all this oil through, we wouldn't have the trains carrying them where they derail and all that, instead of making safer delivery systems. First of all, we shouldn't even be using all this oil and all that. But the general thing is, I think Obama recently tried to pass, get this, voluntary regulation to solve the problem of these trains that are inadequate to carry this oil. He recently wanted to impose, not regulations, but voluntary, voluntary to business, because, you know, he doesn't want Fox News jumping on him for passing a regulation. So, you know, his regulations are always voluntary, all right, whether it's the power grid or whatever, you know, anything with safety, when it's an absolute disaster staring him in the face. He does do regulations, but then they're voluntary. So, of course, the corporations say, oh, okay, voluntary, well, that's going to cost us money, so we can't do it. That's his solution, which is no solution, basically, all right? But the thing is, the XL pipeline is just an utter disaster. And, you know, if that thing leaks, the water supply is tainted and the oil's heavier, and it doesn't create jobs like what they're saying. You know, it's only going to create a few permanent jobs on U.S. oil. And by the way, these oil projects, when Democrats, I think, a while back tried to get something passed where at least the oil would stay in the U.S., that's all got blocked. So it's basically to give another country oil, pass through U.S. soil and give another country oil. We're not even going to benefit by the lower prices that we always hear about, like after the Iraq war that, you know, the oil prices would go way down and the oil it would pay for the war. Remember those early jokes in the media?
Yeah, well, that was the war they were going to welcome us with flowers, right?
Right. And actually, by the way, speaking of welcome with flowers, literally when the Russians go into areas of the Ukraine, certain people, they are welcome with flowers because nobody wants the U.S.-backed Nazis, but that's another issue. But anyway, but as to the oil, that whole thing is a disaster, and I believe he's been quietly approving segments of that pipeline anyway, just not calling it that.
Yep.
So Obama-like.
Yep.
I mean, you know, that's why nobody's voting and nobody has an impetus to go out and vote, because we get candidates that are just useless like that. I mean, I just got to say that. I mean, people that don't do anything for the people, or very little, the bare minimum for the people, and say they're going to do something for the people. You know, he's just totally a fraud.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my view anyway.
Yeah. I was following very closely the issues in West Virginia where all that that water resources were damaged for so many people for so long. And at one point, my colleagues up in West Virginia, I was in touch with several different anti-pollution groups and responsibility groups. And they had a lot of hope when their legislature was going right into session, and they wrote some tough laws that would protect the water resources of West Virginia. But That sneaky old legislature. You know what they did at the last minute? You'll be shocked, I'm sure. They went ahead and exempted one industry.
Oh, my God.
You'll never guess who. The coal industry and their related industries. So they have new tough water pollution laws, except for the people who are most likely to pollute the water.
People got to stop voting for these frauds. I mean, you know, I don't know what to say, but the moneyed interest now that's pouring in, people then say they'll be primary, but people got to work beyond and above that issue. They've just got to say enough is enough and just, I don't know, start showing up and protesting, and I don't know. I don't know what it's going to take.
You know,
the petitions aren't doing it.
They shut off water to 150,000 people, and it wasn't enough to change anything. You know, how bad does it have to get? Let me read you a story, and I'll get your reaction. Groups seek EPA action on toxic air emissions from fracking. Seeking to close what lawyers call the serious gaps in regulation, 64 environmental and community groups on Tuesday petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency to clamp down on toxic air emissions from oil and gas operations. A 112-page petition filed by the public interest law firm Earth Justice asked the EPA to use its authority under the Clean Air Act to develop robust emission standards limiting the amounts of benzene, formaldehyde, and other harmful chemicals that can be released by wells and associated equipment. Some of the documented health effects of many types of hazardous air pollutions admitted during oil and gas production include increased risks of cancer, respiratory disease, and birth defects, among others, the petition says. Emma Kluchus, an Earth Justice lawyer, said in a telephone interview, "People across the United States need leadership at the national level. They need the EPA to act. Most states experiencing heavy drilling have done a poor job of enforcing the federal clean air standards. EPA needs to step in so people won't have to wait years and years for protection." The petition addresses issues highlighted in Big Oil Bad Air, a project unveiled by the Center for Public Integrity, Inside Climate News, and the Weather Channel in February. The series examined air pollution impacts of the Eagle Ford shale boom in South Texas, where nearly 9,000 oil and gas wells have been drilled in the past 5 years through the use of hydraulic fracking or fracturing. Some residents of the region have reported breathing difficulty, nosebleeds, headaches, nausea, and other conditions they blame on emissions from wells, storage tanks, gas processing plants, and other facilities. States like Texas regulate air pollution from oil and gas activities using a patchwork of laws and rules which critics say are often loosely enforced. I think that's probably a real exaggeration. As of 2011, there were more than 1 million wells in the U.S., and as many as 45,000 new wells are expected to be drilled each year through 2035, Earth Justice petition said. Oil and gas expansion brought drilling activities closer to heavily populated areas, including Dallas-Fort Worth, Pittsburgh, Denver, Los Angeles, placing rigs near homes, schools, and workplaces, posing an ever-increasing threat to public health. If this development continues as predicted, more communities will face greater air emission and associated harm. Let me ask you, Lori, is anybody home at the EPA?
Well, if they were home, they were fired. Because they had somebody decent. Wasn't he at the EPA? I can't remember the name, but was it – not sure if it was Van Jones. I may have the wrong name.
Christy Whitman. Christy Whitman.
No, but somebody signed a 9/11 to investigate 9/11, and that person, Fox News didn't like him. So Obama, he was like the only progressive in his administration. Obama got rid of him, of course.
Oh, yeah, that Van Jones, yeah.
Which, by the way, and you may call me like a truther, a Tea Party, whatever, defender, but I believe 9/11 was an inside job 6 ways to Sunday. But
sure.
That's another issue. But, of course, nobody investigated that like Benghazi. But, anyway, forgetting that, that's just an aside. But, yeah, the EPA, they get anybody decent and they're gone. You know, people, it's who they vote for. They've got to stop. You mentioned Texas and all that. And people putting up with their water and all this, I mean, they're going to the polls. They've got to say, we demand a candidate that's going to put an end to this and go in and vote for that person and hold that person to putting an end to it. I mean, the people, these shallow Democrats that do nothing, they frankly in some ways are worse than some of the Republicans because they appear to give you hope, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean.
Absolutely.
And by the way, you brought up the TPP earlier. In that treaty, for example, Connecticut, the governor here, a Democrat, Daniel Malloy, he actually did a decent thing, although he's not been that great. But he signed the law that to label genetically modified food, okay? And now that treaty would mean that other countries could sue Connecticut. And, of course, we're not going to be able to afford a country's, you know. I mean, what are we going to do, face lawsuit after lawsuit against the grocery manufacturers and so forth about labeling GMO food, okay? Now, the thing is that treaty would facilitate those lawsuits. So even if you get somebody in that passes, say, a decent law about regulating fracking, another country could sue the U.S. about those laws, right? So, I mean, sure. I'm not sure about specifically fracking, but some of the laws in the U.S. for the environment could be challenged and overruled, right, under the TPP?
Right.
So this whole thing, I mean, I'm not sure what this is leading to. Maybe perhaps some kind of uprising more successful than the American Spring, but I mean that thing that just happened with 300 people. But you know, we really need some kind of to challenge this stuff. This is ridiculous. I mean, you know, this fracking and the pollution. I mean, the whole kit and caboodle. It's the corporations that are strangling us. We got to just get them off of our backs and out. You know, stop strangling us. That's my view anyway.
Sure. Let me share another story with you that has a very long shadow to it. I call this one Another Kennedy Sacrificed. Carolyn Kennedy, the U.S. ambassador to Japan, got a firsthand look Wednesday inside a Japanese nuclear plant devastated by the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. Kennedy, wearing a yellow helmet and white protective suit with her last name emblazoned on it, toured the Fukushima Daiichi plant for 3 hours with her son, Jack Schlossberg. Sign up for politics. The plant was damaged beyond repair by the disaster, continues to be plagued by leaks of radioactive water. Decommissioning the reactor is expected to take decades. You can add a few zeros to that. It's very hard to visualize and understand the complexity of the challenge when you just read about it. This was a very informative visit, Kennedy told reporters after the tour. She expressed her gratitude to those who are working here every day and to those who showed us around. Kennedy visited the Reactor 4 building and the control room for Reactors 1 and 2. A guide explained how events unfolded. Of course, this would be the PG version. And the reactor shut down after the earthquake. I want to share a couple things with you. I have a contact over in Japan who is with German Public Television. He's toured the plant several times. And he gave us a heads up on some of the issues that really didn't hit the media at all, or in some cases hit it very briefly. That, for example, the cleanup crew is made up of largely Yakuza-hired street people.
Oh, yeah.
And that when these people who have absolutely no training whatsoever, when they're given radioactive badges to detect the amount of exposure, when their badges get exposed to too much radiation, the fix is they just give them a new badge. And,
yeah, no, I believe that.
And they said that they scraped off a top-level topsoil, and they put it in big bags, but they never came up with a plan to put the bags anywhere, so the bags are stacked all over the place. So, I mean, this is a problem that continues. And then in energy news, there were some stories about the fact that, okay, there's another spike, radiation, a new all-time high in the ocean off the Fukushima plant, and, of course, they have no idea how. Now, of course, since there's been a regular history of every time they say there's a new high, what they really mean is there's a new high that we're masking by giving you a much lower number. I mean, it is consistent. So God only knows what level of radiation actually is there. And they keep pouring water into these things. And, of course, the more water they pour in, the more radioactive water they get at the end of this. And, of course, they're trying the experiments with the frozen walls. But that's at the sample stage. It's nowhere near actual implementation, even if that should work. So it's an ongoing disaster that most people would rather not think about, especially since there's an Olympics going there.
Oh, that was unbelievable. There's 2 points about the Fukushima disaster. One, I notice every article in the mainstream always starts with when the earthquake, and they keep bringing that back, the the earthquake and the tsunami hit the reactor. Now, the reason why they do that, I think, is to get people to psychologically think, oh, well, what are the chances of that ever happening again? I never mention that when I do a summary about Fukushima, because that's sort of the excuse, you know, to get people to think, oh, it's like winning the lottery, right? Then the other aspect of the Fukushima coverage is to mention the second worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. And I always cross out since Chernobyl and cross out second. You know, the worst, it's the worst nuclear disaster period, which is another thing. And I noticed that early on, like a couple years ago, there was plans to scrap. Nobody wanted the nuclear power. Then Obama made a visit there and, you know, was kind of probably, although I don't know, said, hey, we got to have a place to dump our waste and stuff for, you know, our weapons and all that. So you don't want to stay away from nuclear. Don't worry, we'll give you money. You know, that's what I'm thinking happened. Then suddenly they're for the nuclear again because Obama subsidizes the nuclear industry all the time, you know, something that doesn't get much media coverage. But there were three meltdowns there or more, and that didn't get coverage either about the meltdowns.
Right. And, of course, our ongoing troubles in New Mexico and Washington State, which, you know, is only destroying the Columbia River. And, of course, the WHIP is out of commission
right.
for a couple years yet. Yeah, it's, you know, it's absolutely terrible. And, you know, if this isn't it, my friend over in Japan was saying to me, well, you know, it's funny because Japan used to have a really vibrant anti-nuke community, but they've been strangely silent. And, you know, I don't think you have to be a 9/11 conspiracy person to say, why would the anti-nuke community be strangely silent with the worst nuclear disaster in their country? Well, do you think they've been somehow compromised? Is it possible that they've been somehow neutralized? Yeah, I'm afraid I'd have to consider that as a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, because the corporations have sort of given the nuclear industry a pass and kind of lumped them over with the energy that doesn't emit carbon. So, you know, it's the better way to go. They've kind of actually co-opted some people. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's a deadly industry. U.S., of course, gave the corporations welfare to start it. I think it was like, what, the Price-Anderson Act of the 50s or something?
Sure, but we still insure them because nobody else will.
Right, they limited their liability to $500 million back then, which was nothing to them. So they said, okay, we'll build the plants. I mean, I never, you know, it seems like this whole country, the socialism towards large corporations is fine, but people can't have socialism. But this, the subsidizing and bailouts of any kind of banks or car companies you know, they got bailed out GM, but then they destroy the unions, and that's the deal they make. But anyway, any kind of bailouts of big business is always fine and welfare and subsidies. But if people need a helping hand with food stamps or something, no, that's no good. That's what it seems to me here.
Yeah, yeah. Another Fukushima story, that this one actually came out of CNN. The push to plug the plumbing problem from hell at Fukushima Daiichi is about to get some help. The reactor is believed to be leaking highly reactive coolant water through a rupture in a donut-shaped chamber at the base of the reactor. Matt Cole, Curion's engineering director, said the arm will be used to inspect three areas around that chamber known as the suppression pool for suspected leaks. They know there's a leak because of the balance of the water, but they don't know exactly where the leak is. The damage to reactors 1 and 3 was dramatically visible. What happened in number 2 has been largely a mystery. Operators reported hearing a bang from deep within the reactor, probably from another hydrogen explosion, and a spike in radiation levels. The unit's turbine plant was soon filled with water that was loaded with nuclear waste, backing up through service tunnels and spilling into the neighboring Pacific. Dozens of gallons per hour. Dozens.
Yeah, I know. I love that. Dozens of gallons. Yeah.
One of the other things that I've heard nowhere else except from my friend over there was that, you know, those plants were built on landfill, and it's over an underground river going to the sea. So, of course, there would be, you know, a massive outflow of water and runoff going from the land side out into the sea. So we'll have to see the pictures of what's been happening to people over in the Chernobyl region are largely completely suppressed. And there was a wonderful wonderful, terrifying seminar held by the Fair Winds Project, where they had scientists from the Chernobyl region talking about Chernobyl, talking about the after effects, and also comparing that to what's going on in Fukushima. It's very, very sobering stuff. And I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but it's definitely worth getting yourself aware of.
Yes, it's an utter disaster, and I'm at a loss as to why, you know, these licenses get renewed, and it's just, yes, and they could add solar and wind, but the corporations couldn't make money on it, so we don't have it.
What stories are you looking for in the coming weeks?
Well, of course, the Ukraine, that issue, that really drives me crazy. Supposedly that in that book in July, I guess there's something going to come out more on Snowden with some big story. You know, Snowden and WikiLeaks have provided a lot of good information. Of course, the answer from President Obama to the Snowden leaks was to privatize, instead of the government storing the data, the corporations will. So how's that going to work? The U.S. has got to pay them for doing the task, and then they'll have total leverage. Talk about too big to fail. They'll have total leverage of doing what they want to do because they'll have this threat over the government's head that they have everybody's data. I mean, that's an insane solution. And it kind of makes me wonder if that wasn't sort of a plan all along, because I really wonder about why that came about. Because, you know, of course, the Tea Party doesn't want the government holding your data. Okay, that one issue I can say, okay. But then their answer is what, the corporations hold our data? I mean, that's insane. That, to me, is worse, because at least the government kind of like somehow, it seems to me corporations will have no laws. Like when when soldiers commit war crimes, there's some kind of laws on the books, but yet when Blackwater did it, it was fine. There's nothing on the books. They can do what they want. So we'll have the same thing with our data, all right? So I kind of wonder really what the whole end result. You know, you got to look at the results, not the words. And I wonder, what is the result of all the Snowden leaks? The corporations will hold the data now and do it, you know, we'll be paying the corporations, right? I mean, how's that going to work? So that's a story that's going to come up, in July? And, you know, WikiLeaks, they've leaked some great items, but I want to know why they don't leak the Dick Cheney Energy Task Force documents that Scalia said didn't after he went duck hunting with Cheney didn't have to be released, because I think that's going to show that the wars were purely for resources on purpose. And I just wonder why nothing on 9/11, the documents on that don't get released, like why Cheney told Nora to stand down. So anyway, I would like to see some decent leaking by WikiLeaks and Snowden about what, you know, things that really would shake things up rather than just saying, you know, okay, what happened in China, you know, and all this that we know. That's just my opinion of these leaks, but hopefully they get more interesting.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I was going to say in that same vein is that our old friend Julian Assange, unfortunately, has been quiet for too long, and they certainly effectively muzzled him by keeping him locked away. It's a shame, and I hope that him and Chelsea Manning, they don't fall completely off the radar screen. God knows they're not as interesting as the Kardashians, but to some of us who believe in the ultimate mission that this country was founded on, hopefully we'll keep their names alive and we'll keep them from disappearing into the black hole.
Oh, I know, and I totally appreciate what they've done, and I wouldn't want to be locked in the same, you know, rooms for 2 years, whatever. I know that, and they're under tremendous pressures. I get it, but I just think if you're going to do it, do it, and say what happened on 9/11, get it out there. I mean, and other issues, not just that one issue, but, I mean, there's got to be some juicy stuff.
I agree.
Especially with that anthrax at Fort Detrick that suddenly Tom Daschle is going to vote no on the Patriot Act, then he gets 100,000 live spores from Fort Detrick, and suddenly he votes yes on the Patriot Act. I mean, I'm just wondering who really had that anthrax release, and it wasn't the guy that the FBI that allegedly committed suicide. I just would like to see some of these documents come out on really what happened with some of these issues, you know, and that's just my opinion.
Absolutely. You know, I think that Glenn Greenwald has done such a great service for this country, and it's a shame to see him under the pressure that he's under. Of course, I can't think of Glenn without thinking of that poor fellow out in California whose car mysteriously drove itself into a tree and exploded.
Oh yeah, that was a, I mean, my God.
The Petraeus story leaker.
Yeah, and I don't think it was about affairs because I don't think people care about that stuff. But yeah, Petraeus is definitely a weird duck, and there's probably some really interesting stories about him that we're not going to hear about now. Yes.
Well, Lori, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been really wonderful to have you as a guest. And if you haven't checked out clg.org, you should definitely do it. It's go ahead.
It's legitgov.org. I just want to say.
I'm sorry.
Now.
Thank you.
Legitgov.org.
A wonderful site, very informative, and Lori and her team provide a great, great resource. So make sure you enjoy it.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Now we're going to go with a little bit of music, and then we'll come back with our next guest in just a minute.
Building a dream, and so I followed them all. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly down. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suit, Archie, we looked swell, full of that Yankee doodly dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare?
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. Our next guest, Ms. Chris Costello, is with us now. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Rick. How are you?
Very, very good. How's one of my favorite Sierra Club people?
I'm doing fine. I've been working in the yard all weekend, so I was caught unawares. I did not have any idea that it was already 8 o'clock at night, so I'm sorry I'm a few minutes late.
Well, that's okay. That's okay. You've been out there in the environment making it a better world every day.
Trying to.
So tell me, the ongoing fight for Florida's water resources has seen some steps progress and some setbacks. What can you tell us about what's going on right now?
Well, we're just a couple of weeks past the legislative session, and so really the big news is what did and didn't happen during the 2014 Florida legislative session and kind of what the plans are following the legislative session. I can just talk about water, or I can throw in a few other things regarding environmental pros and cons.
Feel free to give us an update that only you can do for us.
Well, I think maybe I'll just give an overview of kind of how the environment fared during the legislative session, and then I'll dig into the water issues.
Sounds good.
The legislative session for us environmentalists kind of ended in a draw. It could have been much worse. On the wind side, we were once again able to stop the fracking bills and the really bad environmental regulation bills both died in committee. So that's the really good news. Our defensive work was successful there. Another big win was that there was no preemption attempts on urban fertilizer management at the local level. That was the first time in 7 years that there had been no attempt to keep local governments from managing urban fertilizer. So that was, you know, that was a huge thing, very historic, that we didn't have anything along those lines. But the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services is going to go at urban fertilizer from a couple of different angles, so we're not out of the woods yet in 2014, but at least the legislative session we didn't do too badly. The two big news items for water and really the environment overall in the legislative session were regarding the springs. There was a springs bill and the Indian River Lagoon or the Everglades issues. The springs bill was also a historic endeavor. A bipartisan group of five senators got together and wrote really quite an exemplary springs bill the way it began or where it was kind of in the middle of the process. But that bill, although it was passed unanimously in the Senate, didn't even get heard in committee in the House. So that was not good for water, specifically springs. We did get some good money in for the Indian River Lagoon projects, and I'll cover that in a moment. We made a little progress in terms of positioning for next year on eliminating the preemption of local plastic bag bans. Right now, local governments are not able to ban plastic bags. And we had a little progress in terms of positioning also in terms of listing chemicals of high concern in Florida. But on energy issues, we had no luck at all. In fact, it was really a bad year for energy again, and it's been a bad year for energy issues again and again and again. In addition to not getting anywhere on energy, we lost on two memorials. A memorial is like a message from the legislature to Congress urging them to do something. And one of the memorials that was passed was a message to Congress to allow Florida to be as lax as it wants, or it urged EPA actually to allow Florida to be as lax as it wants in regulating CO2 from coal power plants. So that wasn't good. And the legislature also urged EPA to approve the Keystone XL pipeline, which is a really big no-no as far as environmentalists are concerned. again, overall on water, the big news is that the House, specifically Will Weatherford, the House Speaker this year, and the incoming House Speaker, Steve Crisafulli, Representative Crisafulli, both really dug their heels in and said that they really didn't want to deal with water this year at all and wanted to wait until next year or the year after. It wasn't good news for anyone who knows the critical, serious, dire nature of our water resources here in Florida. We really can't wait. So that was very disappointing. And we'll be spending weeks and probably the next couple of months trying to figure out what our best strategy is for pushing a really unwilling House into doing something next legislative session and pushing FDEP in the meantime to do things that they can do without legislative input. So let's see, what else?
Let me ask you a question before you go on.
Yeah, please.
It seems to me, you know, I heard that, and of course the official statement was, well, you know, the next time the legislature gets good, that's going to be the term when we address water issues. What do you think is behind it? Are they just trying to marshal their own resources to fight what is clearly a public uprising, or is it worse?
I think it's worse. The kind of cryptic message that has been coming from incoming House Speaker Steve Crisafulli is that this water issue is not something that could be dealt with in 1 year, and he wants to deal with the issue over the next 2 years. But what we have heard from insiders is that his interest is in a big omnibus bill relating to water, and that would not be brought to the legislature for a vote until 2016. And I can only say that it seems like political maneuvering with regard to election year cycles, because anybody that has eyes in their head and ears to hear knows that the Indian River Lagoon, the Springs, the St. John's River, the Caloosahatchee River, the Keys, the Southwest Gulf Coast, Apalachicola River, Bay, none of them can wait 2 years for a legislative bill to pass. That's just crazy. So I don't think it's good news at all.
Let me ask you about another issue that did not go well for us and did not go well for those in Florida who, you know, drink water. The ridiculous stance of the Corps of Engineers.
Right.
They refuse to... You know, basically, this none of this is news. You know, they're suddenly going to decide that they're going to review the process really closely. Were they not part of all the negotiations? I mean, this can't be, any of this could be a shock to them.
You know, the way it has been explained to me by folks that have been working with the Corps and know the Corps over the past decade is that The review board, you're referring to SEP, the Central Everglades Planning Project.
Right, where they were trying to get the flow going.
Right, that's right. The Central Everglades Planning Project is a group of water-related projects that deal with the Central Everglades, I mean the Kissimmee River Valley down to Lake Okeechobee and the surrounds. And it is such a large project that in order for it to go forward, it has to be included in the WRDA bill, the Water Resource Development Act bill out of Congress. And those bills, the last WRDA bill that was passed through Congress actually was, I believe, 7 years ago. Now, it should be every other year, but it's been a long time. And the big desire of everyone concerned was to get SEP, the Central Everglades Planning Project, approved and put into this Water Resources Development Act bill that will be passed in the next couple of weeks before Congress goes out on leave again. And the Corps took its sweet time, and in fact, and SEP will not be involved in the, or be included in this WERDA bill, although there are any number of Everglades restoration projects that are going to be included in WERDA this time around. And it's been explained to me that the Corps does its own thing. They, the folks that are on the review board don't want to hear from politicians. They don't want to hear from local or state governments. They do things on their own time, and they would not be rushed. It seems like it had nothing to do. I think it's pretty obvious that it really had nothing to do with SEP itself. And it is, it's really, it's an outrageous act. But I would say that our biggest, the biggest culprit in our water quality miseries here in Florida is certainly the state government and not the Corps. The Corps is bound. I mean, this group of people should have done the right thing and gotten to it more quickly, and that is ridiculous. But the Corps in general is not the big culprit here in this state. It is the state of Florida. It is FDEP. It is Governor Scott. So, yeah, really, really unfortunate. The hope is that the next WERDA bill will come around in 2 years or even less, and SEP will be included in that. It doesn't stop the planning process for SEP, but it certainly slows things down.
You know, I'm afraid I can't find that generosity of spirit that that your advisors are providing. You know, I'm going to speak very bluntly. The fact that the 70-year disaster that was the canal system that needs addressed, not just because the Withlacoochee and the St. Lucie are being destroyed, but that changing of mindset that says we need to be releasing waters southbound to replenish the aquifer, to replenish the glades. This is not a shock to anybody. This is not news. This is not, you know, closely held like the TPP, for God's sakes. These people, you know, I understand that they've got their own little power structure and they want to play their way and nobody can tell them what to do. But excuse me, this isn't their water. It's not their state of Florida. It's not their Everglades. It's not their Lake Okeechobee. It is the water resource for Floridians. It needs to be dealt with. And I think it is so much more than kind, so much more than generous to say, well, you know, and I'm not faulting you. I am not in any way faulting you, but I've heard that kind of thinking, well, the Corps needs to do its own thing. Yeah, you know what? If five of us are here in a room and we're all planning and those guys are called one thing and we're called something else, that doesn't mean we're oblivious to what's going on. And that, to me, is the pass that I'm unprepared to give to the Corps. You know what I mean?
I do, but I'll tell you something. The Corps' job right now is to keep the water from going over the dike. It really is. Now, what the Corps did in the past with replumbing entire South Florida, that's another thing, but that's done. They've been trying to, you know, turn that around for well over a decade now. But their job right now is to keep the water from flooding over the dike, and they do that. Our job, I believe, as Floridians, the state's job is to make sure that the water flows south. And to do that, the sugar land has to be purchased so that water can flow south. Where sugarcane fields stand right now, the Everglades agricultural area, and Governor Scott had the opportunity to get a really good deal on sugar land, that sugar land purchase that Governor Crist started several years ago. Governor Scott had the ability to get the same good deal by last October, and he passed on it. The sugar industry has everyone by their you-know-what, whether they're our U.S. senators or our state legislature are so beholden to the sugar industry because of their massive campaign contributions, including Governor Scott, we can't send the water south until we buy that land. We get that land south of Lake Okeechobee. And so purchasing that land has to come before the Corps can let water go south. We really have to put the onus of responsibility on the state government. We need that land, and as long as it's planted in sugar, the water's not going to flow south.
Well, I would look at it a little differently, maybe a little more radically, and say it's a public resource. It needs to be taken. If they can take a right-of-way for a power line, I think we can take a right-of-way for a water line. And wouldn't it be better than building up a wall that's trying to stop a flow that's intended to flow if you reduce some of that pressure by bleeding some of it off, by letting some of it flow south? But, again, I don't want to argue.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that agree with you. There are a lot of people that are, you know, there are a number of people that are talking eminent domain with regard, especially the people that live along the Indian River Lagoon and lived through the, you know, lost summer last year. A lot of people are talking about that, that it just needs to be taken. The Sierra Club doesn't have a position on that, but you're in good company, Rick.
You know, I understand the lockstep of politicians and rich resource people who've had a free ride for a very long time. I understand that breaking the gridlock there, that Gordian knot of how do you get the politicians to go against the interests of the people that have been funding them, I understand that. And it seems to me that the simple way to cut that knot is to say, look, this needs to happen. It needs to happen for the state of Florida. It needs to happen for the wildlife of the Everglades. It reduces the pressure on the dike. And there's just so many reasons why. And, you know, if we can do this to facilitate FPL, my goodness, the people of Florida, the water resources of Florida, I think that's a higher priority. But enough of that.
I agree with you, Rick. I agree with you. Water is – we can't live without it. We could live without more power lines, but we definitely can't live without drinking water.
Well, that's so true. And I really do appreciate it. And I know you took my comments in the spirit they were offered, not in any way criticism of you, but just simply a reaction to that. Okay, great. So tell us, anything else that we survive with the legislature?
Sure. Well, you know, the budget, you know, water did much better this year than it has before. Again, it could have done much better than it did, but the environment, specifically water and land, got about $400 million in the budget. And that is if $40 million from the state or from the sale of non-conservation lands is realized. So $360 million or $400 million. But $400 million amounts to just over one-half of 1% of the total $77 billion state budget for the coming year. So the environment got a teeny, tiny little fraction of the entire budget. So, you know, glass half full, glass half empty, it just depends on from where you're looking. So that's important to know. Another thing that's kind of interesting is that in that $400 million, there are some kind of funny things that may not necessarily come out to good environmental gains. For example, $10 million is provided for the quiet zone improvements in response to the use of locomotive horns at highway rail grade crossings. So, you know, a lot of the money is for really good projects, and certainly some of it is for questionable things that people aren't going to see a lot of benefit from. The Everglades and Lake Okeechobee Indian River Lagoon projects got $231 million. excuse me, that included water quality restoration at $32 million, SERP, the SERP C44 reservoir that's in the Martin County area, $40 million. C11 South Dade project is $5 million. C43 reservoir, which is more on the Caloosahatchee, actually, $18 million. And the Tamiami Trail project, raising the trail, some additional miles of the Tamiami Trail to let water flow south of the trail, excuse me, got $90 million. Florida Forever got $57.5 million. But again, that comes $40 million of that comes in the sale of non-conservation state lands. So if those non-conservation state lands aren't sold, then Florida Forever does not get that entire amount. What really got the short end of the stick again was Springs Restoration. Springs Restoration only got $20 million. Now, Everglades, Lake O, and IRL got $231 million, and Springs Restoration only got $20 million. There was an additional $5 million for best management practices for agricultural producers, but no one knows what that could mean. And considering that best management practices are all voluntary in the state of Florida right now, that money is questionable. We just don't know if that would really be realized, any kind of benefit would be realized. Springs Restoration really, really did get nowhere. The legislature gave Springs Restoration even less money than Governor Scott wanted to give to Springs.
Let me ask you another question, and this may be a little out of your area, but if it is, fine, we'll go on to something else. But the question I want to ask is, you know, there was quite a bit of energy pulled together to fight the fracking and the injection wells down in the Naples area. Mm-hmm. And yet we find not only was it, again, permitted, but then the driller went ahead and did fracking and did acid injection and violated the rules they even agreed to live under. I mean, that seems to me to be the height of arrogance.
It's the height of arrogance, and I think the other height of arrogance is that DEP knew all of this. This happened in January, I believe, and didn't let any of the stakeholders know about this until just recently, and continued to go through the permit process. So I think that's really the heights of just ridiculous behavior is coming from DEP. I think you know, in the labor movement, we always said a bad manager is the best organizer. And in this case, a bad polluter, Dan Hughes Company, actually did us a kind of twisted favor in showing its true colors so early in the game, because their refusal to do things the right way has now garnered a real antipathy from the local government, Collier County local government. And so their bad acts have organized, energized, mobilized both the populace in that county and in those surrounds, but also the local government. So seeing their true colors early makes it all a lot easier to fight. And Senator Nelson has now given his support to the rejection of the permit.
Who woke him up?
And so it is, yeah, it did. So it's, you know, this is all now. This is all happening now, and we will see how it comes out. But good for us that we finally found out. Bad for DEP for not telling us for so long.
Well, Chris, thank you so very much for coming on. You're always so informative. And you are a precious resource to this state as much as those crystalline springs that have been ignored for far too long. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick. Right back at you. Thanks again.
Okay, you take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Chris Costello of the Sierra Club, a true warrior for our environment, a person who takes the science, takes the environment so seriously. And now I have the pleasure to bring to you one of my other favorite heroes of the progressive arena, my good friend, who I have such tremendous respect for, Mr. Luis Cuevas. Luis, welcome, sir.
How you doing?
Very good. Mr. Cuevas of Progressive Push has been a leader in the progressive movement for so long. Luis, sir, what's on your agenda these days? Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much. Right now, we're looking at the current cycle for the November election, which is looming real big. It's really important. All elections are important, And it seems like for more time that we want to think about every election seems to be the most important one every time. I can't remember how far back we go with that, especially after the debacle of the late 1990s. Here in the state of Florida, when the Bush cadre moved into the governor's seat, and they had already taken over the legislature, when we look at in terms of Washington D.C., it's since the 1994. When really they have, you know, been, the Republicans have had an overwhelming control on and off in the electoral process. But we're looking right now at Tuesday, a big Tuesday with a numerous elections, particularly in the South. We have quite a few interesting ones. But the question here is, how is the Democratic Party going to get out the vote? Is it doing it?
Well, I think, Lewis, they've shown us their
tactics. Where is the evidence?
They've shown us their approach. I think the Democratic Party has, by and large, showed us the approach they want to use. They're going to be running Democrat light or Republican in Democratic costumes.
Exactly.
And that's their plan to roll out the committed progressive activist community.
Yes, incredibly, what they have devised is Steny Hoyer, and here you have Steve Israel, who is in the DCCC in charge of recruitment. And what they're doing is they're running a puppy mill, a blue dog puppy mill, and recruiting everybody that they can get to run, and the latest faux pas that was in South Florida, where they actually recruited an individual they thought it matched the Republicans, in terms of what they push. Here is an ex-military. He's a man of, business and so on and so forth. And it so happens that they don't tell the Democrats that this guy hasn't been a Democrat for even a year. They pulled the same trick some time ago, 2 years ago, when they put in Pat Murphy in South Florida on the other coast. And they, essentially he has gone back to his roots. Obviously, he's been voting with the Republicans most of the time, and has one of the lowest, the worst voting records. So here's the situation, and it has been happening for too many years. if you think about it, the Blue Dog Coalition was established way back in 1994. And the reason for calling themselves the Blue Dogs was essentially that they claim that they were being turned blue because they were being strangled by the liberals, if you can believe that.
Oh, those powerful, well-funded liberals.
Exactly. And so that they were going to stand, they created a coalition. Interesting enough, one of their founders, as soon as he got the coalition built, of course there was that turnaround of the 1994 election, then he bailed out, went for the Republicans, retired, and became the boss of Big Pharma. Talk about the revolving door right there. That was more like a little tornado, in terms of how that went with that election. But, they became a force within the Democratic Party. Really, the Progressive Caucus was not anywhere near, you know, in terms of strength of what these guys had at one time. They had multiple seats in Congress, and at a time they had over close to 100 seats, and they dominated for most of the time. You know, they were the ones who blocked the initial efforts at universal health care and health care plans of the 1990s during the Clinton administration. They were, you know, very effective in blocking that off and killing it. And they continued until the election of 2010, when there was a rebellion among the voters, and eventually people just had enough. And there was a, you know, and the media never covers it that way, but there was a tremendous, let me say, pulling of the rug, if you will, when people said enough is enough. We don't want to vote for blue dogs. And they collapsed at that time, and they dropped to numbers in the lower 20s in the House. And in the Senate, they had about 13, though the senators were always very very careful never to talk about themselves as blue dogs or, you know, talk about such a coalition. They don't need to, because, you know, at the Millionaires Club, they all, you know, speak the same language, sort of, at that situation. But what we have there is that essentially there were blocks, tremendous blocks, put in the way of any progress. And the last big ditch effort was that they, the Blue Dogs, had was with the first of all, killing universal health care, 676. They made sure it didn't go anywhere. Here we had Baucus, who actually pushed what we now know as Romney Care, and he put together most of it, which ended up being the ACA, with the, you know, the Republicans pushing in what they wanted. And eventually they hated it because, you know, it came out to be under the presidency of Obama, you know, and so they wanted to kill it and call it Obamacare at that time. But here is the thing. It is something that has been tearing the Democratic Party, you know, really bad. It's been hurting. And progressives are now beginning to look kind of a, you know, renaissance in terms of a movement, and they're pushing harder than ever before in a long time. We still need the Congressional Caucus to be more active. They have numbers, but they don't have the clout with the administration. You know, there is a crux of the problem. And then there is a question about that so-called professional left that works with the Democratic Party. And so, you know, who are the professional left? It's something that the media created, and they've been bouncing around. But what I'm worried about is what that's going to do, all that problematic is going to do to the people who are in the districts at the local elections voting, and they don't see connections. And they're being overpowered, and people like Steve Israel choose their candidates, tell them whom they're going to vote for. And here we see the crisis of all this that we're talking about in the election of 2014, when we are having an ex-Republican now being the Democratic Party almost fait accompli candidate for the November election for the governorship. and the people, you know, are looking in terms of, well, you know, what is practical, what is not, some say. And the truth is that when you look at what has been called the establishment Democrats, well, they're going for Christ. And they're going to, you know, it's showing. In the current, reports that are coming out, Nan Rich is not heard of at all. She's not even mentioned.
Let me ask you a question. This is kind of a bare knuckles political muscle question, and I think that your long connections here in Florida may give us some insight, sir. We've seen Democrats shunted off in the past. We've seen the party dangle little benefits and reduce competition, reduce a field to the favorite candidate. The first question I'm going to ask you is, what deal do you think they're trying to press on Nan Rich to get her to bow out so they can have their anointment?
Yeah, that is really interesting there. There's a lot of pressure. In terms of who is the kingmaker in the Democratic Party, right now the biggest kingmaker is Senator Nelson. He's been offering himself, see if somebody will beg him to do it, to run for governor. But nobody wants him to do that. And he's been told, you know, please don't, stay away. But in terms of the situation, it looks like the party establishment has been pushing for Nan Rich. I think that, you know, she will go all the way, bless her heart, but, she, you know, if you think about it, she's got no earned media. She does not get any time out there in the on TV or anything. There's no advertising whatsoever. We are already running towards the end of May, truth is that all the money to be had is in the hands of Christ. That's where the donors are going for all the events that Nan Rich has and that she's running around the state. It's usually, a rally is when you get 100 people. When Chris goes to an event, he's got 300 or more. And who goes there is the question, and the answer to that is it's the establishment Democrats. They have already decided. They don't want to put a show that Nan pull out. But I think that there's a tremendous amount of pressure for her, for the good of the party, to get out. There's no alternative. And the question is, what are progressives going to do? What are the voters going to do with this situation? Many of them don't even have a clue as to what is going on.
Let me ask you another crystal ball question, if I may, sir. I want you to look in your crystal ball and see what you think about this. We've got Senator Nelson, who is nominally a Democrat for our state. I think that's being over generous. But eventually, like all things, he will come to an end. Who do you think the party is going to push to replace this nominal Democrat at the federal level? Who do you think they're grooming?
That's the $64,000 question right there, because there is absolutely nothing looming in the horizon as to federal candidates. Not just for the, I mean, if you're thinking about it, you know, not only Nelson, but also who is going to be the challenger to Rubio. And there's nobody there.
You mean they're going to run someone against Rubio? Aren't they just going to endorse him?
That's the question, yes. That's the big question. They're going to pull a Chris Christie like they did in New Jersey, where they actually, the Democratic Party, pulled the rug from under Buono, the Democratic candidate, and they virtually endorsed Christie. And, you know, they gave him a green light. And he almost, you know, he ran unopposed because they would not support their own candidate. And here the question is, what are they going to do? Throughout, if you're looking at the one by one of the federal races in the state of Florida, the state doesn't get involved with them. It's really tricky. The one that they are working on, it's actually in the panhandle, Congressional District 2, where they have Graham's daughter running for the U.S. Senate. And for the U.S. Congress. And, you know, that's Graham. And then, you know, of course, you know, it's similar to the situation in Georgia where they have the daughter of Sam Nunn.
Right.
So if they're playing the dynasties.
Sounds like democracy to me, huh?
Yeah. And so who is going to go after, after a person like Rubio, or who would go over to get the seat for Nelson? The only people that you have of stature would be Alan Grayson, which it doesn't seem like the Democratic Party has much love for in terms of the establishment here. You don't see too much love there, and they pretty much left him on his own when he lost the election in 2010. His comeback was because he got into, you know, manipulating the situations and then he got into the gerrymandering and got back in. But when you're looking at stature, well, whatever happened to Robert Wessler?
He sent it off to the Israel lobby.
Yeah, I mean, he just boomed. He just, you know, gave up his congressional seat at the peak of his political career, disappeared, hasn't been heard from, unless, you know, it's with that lobby. And then you look at around and, okay, who's next? And you're going to see that they're going to pull for Alex Sink again.
While we're talking about national, let me ask you another question. And this is, I have to say, almost more for comedy relief than anything else. You know, I wonder, is Karl Rove on the Clinton payroll? This comment that Hillary's logic and reasons called the question. Now, could you ask for a better enemy than Karl Rove? I can't imagine one.
It is amazing. I think that when that you have Karl Rove and the what's his guy Morris, that, you know, the two come out and they always say, you know, this is going to happen, and everything goes out the other way. I think that Karl Rove has reached the limit of his of his ride. In politics, the so-called genius has blown it several times. In whose mind does it enter that. You know, let's say we're going to run the 2016 campaign from now until 2016, saying that she has, mental problems and, that type of thing, and Benghazi.
On another more serious national note, sir, let me ask you about this recent travesty of justice, the conviction of Cecily McMillan basically being accosted by a policeman. She's now serving prison time for the natural reaction of someone grabbing you forcibly from behind. Do you think that we're running close to the limit of how much police brutality is going to be tolerated in this country?
I think we have crossed the line. I think that this is something that we've been watching since the Bolsheviks were in power, and we forget that they are still in power in many of the states.
Yep.
And there was the militarization of our police forces. Bush and his cadre, they pretty much use the tragedy of 9/11 to then go out and say, to the police forces throughout the country, you are the first line of defense. And they began to then give them all kinds of assistance, most of it, if not a lot of it, militaristic, to the point of creating a fortress mentality in many of the police forces. And the reaction that they are having, and we saw it through the Occupy, the struggle when the big cities began to actually coalesce the mayors, even though they denied it, and they did have called conferences about it, and they worked out a plan about the midnight raids, how they would go out and at 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning, they would go out and raid the encampments when nobody was watching, when everybody was asleep, when the media were not covering, and that type of thing. And they would just come in, clubs in hands, busting heads, tearing tents, setting them on fire, that type of behavior, that was there. And that continues to be the case. So that when we hear about all these events in other countries like Turkey and what they've done in Egypt, so on and so forth, brutality, people didn't realize, don't go back and think in terms of we've been using water cannons here. We've been experimenting with using our police departments, that is, have been using these sound bombs that essentially leave people deaf because they just numb. It's an extraordinary force that hits them. And least of all are the rubber bullets that they use on people.
Let me ask you about one other issue that's very important and pressing on us heavily. Essentially, what we've seen across the South is the de facto recriminalization of abortion and shutting of abortion clinic after abortion clinic. Obviously, the Supreme Court's going to be no friend of human rights and women's liberty. What do you see? Do you see this being the new thing that they've found an effective end around? They're going to be basically recriminalizing abortion?
They will. If nothing happens in November, and I'm talking not just in Congress, because in Congress they're actually getting to that point. They will. If the Republicans win the House and the Senate, you can forget about the abortion rights. they will, you know, immediately move in. We have, you know, these people are fanatics. Now, let me tell you, I've got something from the cynical side of the political campaigners, what they are saying.
Go ahead.
You know, and that is that the Republicans might not actually do away with the abortion rights, because if they did, they would lose a tremendous fundraising mechanism.
Gotcha.
That's what they use to get all this money into their hands, and you know, that is what one side of the political professionals are looking at. I think that what we have in terms of the Republican Party are the wing nuts, right wing nuts, part one and part two. You know, there's no moderates there anymore. I keep saying that the last Republican moderates left the party in 1912. with Teddy Roosevelt. But what you see there is essentially that you have two right wings vying for control of the Republican Party, and then you got one that is a little bit more practically, if not money-wise, oriented. And, you know, it's a matter of who gets a stranglehold on power in the Republican Party, and if the Democrats are going to allow them to win the, you know, the November House and Senate. And that would be disastrous if they did. But as to the, if you leave it to the fanatics of the Republican Party, they will go after women's right to choose and to control their bodies. It will be the beginning of the subjugation, or the culmination of the subjugation of women to this patriarchy that the Republicans want to sustain. The question is who gets an upper hand there. It really sounds extremely cynical that these people sit back down there and says, okay, what do we do to people so we can raise funds for the party? But needless to say, the same thing is happening with veterans, how they are abandoning them. On a given night, 63,000 veterans are homeless. Any time of any day of the year, and 900,000 veterans are on food stamps. So if they don't care for the people who they sent to war, use them as cannon fodder, then they drop them where they come back, together with the yellow ribbons. They left them behind. We expect for them to do to everybody else. They are criminalizing the poor, the homeless. They're going beyond that to, create stigmatizing them, and worse than the 1980s under Reagan. And they're criminalizing women. They're going after women in terms of, did you have a condition there that led to an abortion? Were you pushing it this way or the other? Leaving no
sure.
way, for them to. I mean, were you in a place where they were smoking? Oh, let's give that to a DA. Did you have a beer? Let's jail her. That type of behavior.
Well, sir, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I want
well,
to
thank
tell
you.
You, we appreciate the hard work that you're doing every day. And from Progressive News Network, I want to say, sir, I hope we can have you back often.
Thank you so much. That would be lovely. Thank
okay,
you
take
for
care,
your work.
Thank you, brother.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Good night. And if you can't support Progressive News Network, please, we urge you to contact us. We can support, or this show is going to see its midnight. So thank you so much for joining us. I want you to support other progressive broadcasters, our good friends, Anita Stewart, Gwen Holden Berry, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Sita Beguile, and of course our good friend Susan Nylon of the Nylon Report. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a-plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer just a-knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. And the vaults are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. I've seen